morning and welcome to Home Fires Radio Show. With me in the studio this morning are two geographers, Professor Don Lynch and Dr. Nigel Allen. Welcome. Geography is a field. We were talking just before we went on the air. My sense is that my parents had more elaborate geography classes, more elaborate geography knowledge than we perhaps do today. It was definitely a part of the basic subject curriculum in grade school and high school in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. Students had to memorize all of the names of the capitals, the mountain ranges, and so on. And my sense is that it's not such a prominent part of the curriculum now. Am I mistaken?
I would say that that's a very traditional approach to geography. Geography is really a point of view rather than some discipline in which you can merely recite the names of capitals of the United States. In my own work, for example, it would be regarded as a little bit of agronomy, perhaps, some in environmental science, some in social science, probably a little bit more in social science. And it's my point of view, this interaction of man and the environment, which is the driving force behind the type of geography that I would do.
Well, it is true that what we call place geography has been downgraded in the American school system. But there have been plenty of studies to demonstrate the geographical ignorance of Americans. But let us not forget that such subjects as English and math and history have also been downgraded. The president's recent studies on the woeful condition of science in the American school system are to be, I think, actually understate the case. That we're coming out of, from my viewpoint, a decade in which we seriously shortchanged the basics in American education, primary and secondary schools, and that included geography and the place geography you're talking about. As far as what is geography as a discipline is concerned, I would share very much what Nigel said. Geographers are concerned with the total environment in which people live. Some people like to call it a holistic discipline. And you're looking at how people affect the landscapes, how the environment affects people. And these are classic, unending questions with, of course, great utility in any kind of planning function.
How did you first choose this field?
Myself?
Mm-hmm.
I was very fortunate. I graduated from high school when I was 16 and was given a scholarship to Phillips Academy Andover thanks to an absolutely wonderful person, Hugh P. Brady, who was the son of Governor Brady of Alaska. And from Andover, I obtained a scholarship to Yale, where I majored in Russian studies and history. And in the process, I was exposed to geography. There was Harold Wean's Geography of Asia, which at that time was a standard introductory course. Just as an aside, it is interesting that geographers in the 40s thought, and the 30s, thought Asia was extremely important. And it was, for many institutions, the introductory course. And then I had a course in the geography of Soviet Union and simply fell in love with the discipline. And then took a graduate program that combined Russian studies and geography. But when you get the geographic bug, I don't know how other people are, but when you get it, you never lose it. Something bites you.
Yeah, I like to emphasize that I came at it from another direction. Geography is a highly developed subject, both in the high schools and, of course, in the universities. And some universities, for example, Sheffield University in England, they must have about 60 faculty in the geography department. So it's very well developed over there. But I like to think of it that I came to it as a schoolboy, not as a formal subject, but as a part of my culture in a way. I remember as a young schoolboy in the summer times, I used to go and visit an aunt who lived just on the edge of the highlands, and her husband was a blind fellow, and he used to take me along the hedgerows and these small rights of ways and you had asked me to interpret the landscape. What do I see in over there? What is growing in such and such a field? Where are the which fields are the sheep in? Have they moved to the higher rough grazing, or are they still in the low areas? How large are the lambs, for example? And so, built into the culture itself was this very strong feeling of this unity between, as I mentioned previously, between man or humans and the landscape itself. And that is, I think, deeply ingrained in British culture. There are many programs on the television where one goes back throughout history and traces the evolution of man's imprint on the landscape. So I think in Britain, there is a strong sense of where you are in the natural landscape itself, while there is a very strong component to in the high schools and the universities of geography as an academic subject. I have nephews who take these universal exams they must take, and I'm always astonished to see the breadth and the detail of the formal questions which they are presented with in their examinations when they graduate from high school. And we certainly don't see that in the United States. For some reason, many people in the United States are aspatial, shall I say, without a sense of locality. And just an anecdotal instance here, when I mentioned to someone that I was coming via Alaska, coming back from Beijing, China, they said that this is extremely out-of-the-way direction. I said, not at all. You just take the European plane from Tokyo and you get off in Anchorage. It's quite a simple procedure. And the same could be said, of course, of my hosts here, my sister-in-law and her husband, who, when being stationed in Alaska, everybody thought they were in the farthest place from civilization. In actual fact, it's almost equidistant from the northeastern seaboard and northern Europe and of course, Tokyo and Beijing, the big centers in Asia, too.
Absolutely. I had Lydia Black as a guest, and she was bemoaning the fact that the way the Alaskan map must, by necessity, in order to fit on a neat rectangle, be often cut up, and the Aleutian chain sort of inserted into the map, and that people have, as a result, quite a distorted idea of the distance and the connection of Alaska to other land masses.
If you want to have fun with American students, ask them which way north is, and you will find 90% of them don't know. I've been amazed to find that there's a very high percentage of students right here on our own campus who cannot find the North Star. It's amazing, but it's true. Another fun one is to ask people where the sun rises and sets, and they don't know. And that's the school system. If you take the standard map, it'd be a rectangular map of the United States, and you'll find Alaska and Hawaii normally situated to the west of Acapulco, Mexico. So that people don't know where we are is by no means accidental. It is a consequence of the type of maps, the type of teaching, and the type of TV that we have in the United States. But it's not just Alaska. It's worldwide. I remember very vividly the anti-Vietnam protest movements. And it was always delightful to take people who were protesting about Vietnam and give them a blank map and say, find it. And you'd be surprised how many people couldn't. But they were opposed to it, whatever it was. You have a similar thing today with the term Mideast. And we talk about the Mideast when perhaps we ought to talk about the Persian Gulf or the names of some of these countries. I had a fascinating conversation the other night over the question of South Yemen. There was a revolution there. And I lost the argument. I was talking with four people who were convinced that South Yemen was vitally important because it produced all the oil exported to the United States. They had mixed up South Yemen with Saudi Arabia. The funnest one I ever had, though, was a young fellow who got very upset with me. He told me that it is 2,500 miles from Fairbanks to Barrow. And we almost it almost came to blows. And finally asked him how he knew that. Well, his father was a doctor, owned an airplane. And they had flown, and he remembered it very carefully, and they had flown from Fairbanks to Calgary to Edmonton to Barrow. And it was 2,500 miles, as he recalled, and therefore it was 2,500 miles from Fairbanks to Barrow. And there was no way he was going to believe me when he'd had this marvelous experience with his father.
First-hand learner.
The same thing with our standard Series E map of Alaska. It places the Aleutian south of Anchorage, and it totally ignores the Yukon Territory. The Yukon Territory is, it's not totally ignored, but it's colored white. Canadians refer to the 141st meridian, the main boundary between us and the Yukon Territory, as the 141st fault, because nothing crosses it on the maps.
I'm speaking with geographers Don Lynch and Nigel Allen about the subject of geography. For those of us who have not taken a college-level course in geography, what might one find in the syllabus for such a course, just to give us a little firmer base? And
I don't think there's too much difference between what is in the curriculum at the basic level here at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks, and what we teach in a large state, land-grant university, which is the prime university in the state, at Louisiana State University. I teach a course which I call jokingly around half the world in one semester. And the portion of the world that I deal with is the area I'm concerned with, which is Asia and Africa. And then other faculty in another semester take care of the Europe itself and what we call the Neo-European realm, which really means the Americas. So we have this large introductory class, and that introduces the students to what we call cultural realms. These are large cultural complexes. Europe, of course, is one. India would have to be another one, and China would be another one. In the United States, we see a trans-European influence here across the Atlantic, and we have the cultural realm of the United States. It, of course, when one moves to South America, it becomes a little bit more difficult to identify one of these. So the students then are introduced in looking at major civilizations, some much grander in the past than present, and then they're able to relate the peripheral areas, for example, Southeast Asia, to both India, the Indian subcontinent, and China, and to see how things fit in. Now, of course, there are many people living in some nations, and there are other places of contemporary importance of which perhaps receive a little bit more attention because of the strategic value, and this, of course, would include the Persian Gulf. I spend some time now even discussing United Arab Emirates, which is a group of very small sheikhdoms in the Persian Gulf. But when one looks at their importance on the world petroleum scene, then they become quite important. And, of course, we get into Africa, too, and we divide that up into Africa north of Sahara, south of the Sahara. And the students, when they come out of that class, have a good idea of how the world is fitted together. Now, and to understand these places, the students must learn the basic vocabulary, and the vocabulary of such a course would be names of countries, names of regions, and names of cities, among rivers and mountains, amongst other things. So it does require a certain amount of almost rote learning to comprehend the idea of major cultural realms in this world. So that's a little bit boring for some of the students, but it's a necessary precondition to understanding how everything fits together. That's the introductory class, and then we move up through another set of courses there, some of which are more technically oriented. This could be air photo interpretation, it could be basic map reading, it could be cartography, in which one makes maps oneself, and statistics would be included, and now we have quite a bit of hardware in our department for automated cartography, and we also have a large section of courses which deal with emphasis more in the physical geography, weather and climate, meteorology, and also in the human aspects of geography, which would be cultural geography, something along that end. So there is a specialization at the junior and senior level, but also at the same time, the students learn basic tools, and we have no problems in enrollments at those levels because it's, in many instances, it is those basic tools which get students jobs, and there's a great demand, especially in South Louisiana, for geography majors these days because they have basic tools which companies need desperately, and the wages for some of the students are quite high, relatively speaking.
Okay. What kind of companies, what kind of businesses need geographers, and what do they do for those companies?
Well, in many instances, the primary business in South Louisiana, of course, is offshore oil and mm-hmm. gas. And there are many conflicting claims as to rights about these things. And so many oil companies, for example, and those companies associated with the major ones, wish to have technical staffs which can look at the spatial organization of their leasing lots and things mm-hmm. like that, and also they also have to meet many federal requirements as to environmental impact statements and things like that, and so geographers become actively involved in looking at some of these materials too, and because the nature of the discipline combines human factors and physical factors, and really no other discipline does that. They can be quite technical. Engineers do engineering. Anthropologists and archaeologists can look at remnants of past cultures in those areas, but it's the geographer who, from his perspective, combines the physical and the human aspects to it. And so many companies now see that it's profitable and to hire geographers.
Your early example of walking along the fields and seeing where the sheep were, how the contour was, but all of the questions that you were being asked at that time were really, what about this terrain invites certain kinds of activities and invites certain kinds of habitation?
That's true up to a certain point. But if one goes further in that direction, you would run into the problem of environmental determinism. Humans have a great range of choices, and one can see whether some are neglected and others which conform to their society or cultural values would be emphasized. And so one is always confronted with the problem of what is purely of human design or what exists on the landscape, which may be a function of some environmental factor. And I, as a mountain geographer, am always confronted by this problem of filtering through these factors and trying to determine which is of a social or cultural origin and what item on the landscape is a product of the physical environment.
To give us some examples of...
Oh, yes. Food habits, for example. I have just come from the Karakoram Mountains, which are bound the extreme western China and northern Pakistan. And in that area, there are several valleys there, each with a different language. One of them, of course, is known as Shangri-La. That's the Valley of Hunza. And in Hunza, one finds a certain set of crop complexes, and the crop complex is totally inadequate at the present time to feed that population. Consequently, the government is subsidizing food imports into that valley to keep them alive. And I have been engaged through a variety of grants in trying to determine what is the ideal crop complex for that area. Now, to determine this, and these are the questions the economic development agencies want to know, to determine this, one has to look at the cultural components, one has to look at the physical components. In mountains, and these are steep mountains, for example, local relief is something like 20,000 feet. That's from the low point in the valleys to the nearby mountains. And in a distance of, say, 10 kilometers, which is really dramatic. One has to determine how these crops are grown, and are they grown because they're a function of people's choice and foodstuffs, or because that is the only crop which can be grown in that specific locality where a certain microclimate might exist. So this is what's quite difficult about that situation, is juggling these agronomic variables, juggling the environmental variables, and also food preferences. For example, there is a record, British record, of these people eating potatoes in 1892. Yet if one goes there, you will find that hardly any potatoes are eaten. Now, in that area, it so happens that the world record for potatoes was achieved just last year, 92 tons per hectare, which is astronomical. So there's no problem with potatoes growing in that area, yet the people, for some reason, do not eat potatoes, and they would rather go with substandard grain crops, such as wheat and such as barley. And, of course, we're now interested in why do these people persist in growing these grain crops when alternative food systems would be much more beneficial from a nutritional standpoint in the population.
Your specialty, you've told us, is mountains, but also you mentioned Asia, and I know that you have a specialty in Afghanistan. I think that that's an area that, well, it's obviously been in the news a lot lately, but it's also an area that's been quite isolated from normal tourist travel. And so by virtue of its geography, I mean, going back many centuries.
Well, I first went to Afghanistan to do my doctoral dissertation field research. Prior to that, I had done some work in Nepal. I'd done some work for United States Agency for International Development in the Indian Himalaya, and I'd also been in Kashmir. I ended up for a variety of reasons, in Afghanistan, and did my doctoral dissertation field research in several valleys of the central Hindu Kush Mountains, which is that area immediately to the north of Kabul, the capital of Afghanistan, which is located more in the eastern portion there. Afghanistan is one of these freaks of the 20th century, where it was created essentially by imperialistic powers, and it has continued into the 20th century, and now we see a kind of self-destruction of this country itself. It has a rather checkered background. It has always been, various portions of it have been parts of other domains, and it wasn't until really 1880 when the imperial British in India and the imperialist Tsarist Russians couldn't really make up their mind where to draw a boundary between these two major, and in those days they were almost colonial realms. The Tsarist Russians were moving into Central Asia, that would be Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan and what is now Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan. They were moving into this area, and the British were very anxious to set a limit to their northwestern domain in the Indian subcontinent. And they really didn't know where to draw the line, so Afghanistan was created at the Conference of Zema in 1880, where they essentially agreed to place a popular strongman, a chieftain, and create him as an emir, or one of these petty kings, and put him in charge in Kabul, Afghanistan. And once he was placed in there with the approval of these two groups, then he decided to conquer all these lesser chieftains, and out of that came the modern nation state of Afghanistan. There are, of course, many references in hundreds of years ago to Afghanistan as the land of the Afghans, but that's essentially how the modern nation state of Afghanistan came about. Now, there's great confusion arising over the use of the term Afghans. We would say that we view it in a nation state perspective, that the people of Afghanistan are Afghans, but that's only one of three meanings in which the word is used. It can mean, one, a citizen of Afghanistan. Two, it can mean that the person is a member of a number of tribes which speak a language called Pashto. And third, it can, in its strictest sense, it can mean a very small number of those tribes who call themselves Afghan. The only number, about six or seven. It's very interesting to note that virtually all of these people who are the real Afghans do not live in Afghanistan, but live in the northwest frontier province of Pakistan. And we shouldn't forget, too, that in addition to Afghanistan being the land of the Afghans, the word Pakistan itself, the P stands for Punjab, which is a major province. A stands for Afghania. They have claims to that territory occupied by the ethnic Afghans in Afghanistan. K is for Kashmir, and the Istan is for Balochistan. And so we can see that there are claims of Pakistan to that portion of Afghanistan, essentially the eastern portion, in which these ethnic Afghans live. Now, in addition to the ethnic Afghans, there are about six other identifiable groups in Afghanistan. The ruling group until 1978 came almost exclusively from this Pashto-speaking group, and they maintained their authority by force. For example, in 1975, there were 29 provinces in Afghanistan, and all but one of the governors of these provinces was a Pashtun. The royalty, which was pitched out in 1975 when the king had left the country, his cousin took over, the royalty all came from Pashtun tribes. To maintain their control over the country, then many other groups, ethnic groups of total different languages, quite different ethnic groups, some Central Asian in origin, some from really Southwest Asian in origin, these groups were forcibly suppressed by this government. So I see the so much of what has occurred in Afghanistan in the last 7 or 8 years, not so much as merely the Russian incursion, but the failure of a nation state to really look after the welfare of its occupants. And essentially, I think that Afghanistan self-destructed before the Russians moved in. We sometimes forget that there was massive executions and killings long before the Russians moved in, as the Afghanistan, various factions of it, were trying to sort out who would control the country itself. In addition to these basic ethnic divisions, there are regional divisions within them. But since the 1960s, and with education being provided in the rural areas, but more importantly in Kabul University, we can see that there's political ideology mixed up with this now, where we have Marxist ideology superimposed on top of a very traditional tribal set of values, cultural values. And so and don't forget, there are three major sects of Muslims in Afghanistan, and they're all quite different too, Sunnis and Shias. And up in northeastern Afghanistan, there's a good number of Ismaili Muslims, and they're, relatively speaking, quite liberal Muslims. They're the followers of the Aga Khan, and the Aga Khan can be thought of the titular leader of this group, and they're very liberal. The women are rarely veiled on occasion. These mountaineers, like most mountaineers around the world, drink some alcohol, and they don't observe Ramadan, and they have very progressive views towards education, and one finds coeducational schools in this area, and much greater equality for females in this small area of Afghanistan, too. So on top of that, we have people who are progressive Muslims, and now, especially in the resistance groups, which are based in Peshawar and Pakistan, we find extremely orthodox, conservative, fundamentalist groups now appealing to substantial segments of the Afghanistan population. So we have all these cross-currents going, and it's a very complex area. There's lots of shades of gray, and you shouldn't look at Afghanistan as merely the good guys versus the bad guys, or in black and white or in polar opposites. It's a very complicated situation. And I myself, having studied it now for over 15 years, really don't see any simple solution on the horizon. It can only be the cessation of hostilities there can only be worked out between the two superpowers. After all, it was two superpowers which created Afghanistan, Russia and British India, and I can only see it being solved by two superpowers, United States acting as a proxy for Pakistan and also the Soviet Union itself.
We've been listening to Dr. Nigel Allen, who's a professor of geography at LSU and has a specialty in Afghanistan. Describe the country there. We've seen some film footage and so on, but is it in fact extremely rugged? Is it difficult to get from one part of the country to another, even now?
When one looks at the country, the first question that comes to the mind is, why would anybody argue over this piece of real estate? It is almost devoid of forests. There is a little bit of natural gas and petroleum exploration carried out under the auspices of the Soviets in the north. There's really no major economic endeavor in the country itself. It's a tribal society, and much of the occupation of the occupations of the population is essentially subsistence agriculture. It's extremely rugged. It doesn't make much sense as a country because until 1964, was divided by the Hindu Kush Mountains. Now, most people fall into the trap of saying that the crest of a watershed should be a political boundary, but they frequently ignore the fact that people who live in mountains live on either side of the crest. There's usually one group which acts as a broker between the people in the plains on one side and the people on the plains on the other side, and they make their livelihood negotiating and carrying produce and people from one side to another. That's essentially how Switzerland built itself up, of course. But in Afghanistan, it's a little different in that the Hindu Kush Mountains, which split the country east to west, are not only a physiographic divide, but they're also a fairly good cultural divide. North of the Hindu Kush Mountains, we have essentially Central Asian people. We have people speaking Turkic languages, and we also have one speaking a variation of a Persian language, and it's called Tajiki. Now, south of that area, there is a close affiliation, not with Central Asia at all, but with South Asia, and in this regard, I mean the present nation-day states of Pakistan and India. And if one even looks at it from a physical anthropological viewpoint, you can see that there is a trend in the physiognomy of the people going from the north to the south across the country, and the north being really Central Asian and the south being South Asian. However, that's a kind of racial designation. One should really look at the cultural components, and we can see that it's really made up of very diverse groups. For example, in the interior of the country, there's a group called the Hazaras. They're very Mongoloid-looking, but they speak the Persian language, and they're Shia Muslims. So we see these totally discrete units scattered all over the country itself. The rugged topography and the anarchic ways of many of these people prevented much movement in the 19th and 20th century in the country. It wasn't until really the early 1930s that any road of any sorts was created between South Afghanistan and Northern Afghanistan. This went out the route north of Kabul itself and then over the Hindu Kush. But many people had traveled over the Hindu Kush itself. In fact, if you read some of the ancient works by Ptolemy, he talks about the Triadon, and this was the area where three roads went north from one village over the Hindu Kush itself, and so there was travelers always in historic times going over the Hindu Kush itself. But for wheeled vehicles, it didn't really occur until 1930s. And then in 1964, there was a major change made in Afghanistan. At that time, a high-altitude tunnel was completed through the Hindu Kush. This was the first all-weather route between southern Afghanistan and northern Afghanistan. At the time of its construction, it was the highest motor vehicular tunnel in the world. I think it wasn't until the completion of the Eisenhower Tunnel west of Denver on Interstate 70, which was just a matter of a few feet higher and not as long, that the tunnel, the so-called Salang Tunnel, fell into second place. Now, when that tunnel was built, only a fool would think that the Russians had built this extremely expensive tunnel for a few nomads to chase their goats through once in the spring and once in the fall. It was constructed and financed by the Russians, and quite clearly they had designs on that area of Afghanistan south of the Hindu Kush when they were building the tunnel itself. And, of course, this tunnel today, now, is the lifeline of all the Russian effort in the southern portion of Afghanistan. The whole city of Kabul is supported by this lifeline. The entire route of this road has been completely cleared of all villages in this area because of the resistance factions who have managed to sabotage so many of these fuel and food supplies convoys coming down through the Salang Tunnel itself. So in terms of basic communication, we can see that the country was really cut into two. In the 1930s, there was some truck traffic went across during the summer times, but it wasn't until 1964 we saw rapid movement of all weather traffic going between the south and the north. And, of course, the Russians played a very strong role in bringing that to Afghanistan itself.
I seem to be hearing you say that really there's never been a strong nationalistic Afghani identity on the part of
had there been normal citizens. Had there been such a strong identity, this resistance war over the Soviet Union would have succeeded. I think that's one statement that really can't be refuted. When one looks at the resistance groups, there are seven main resistance groups, all appealing to people of certain cultural attitudes or ideologies. Some of them are extremely conservative groups. Some are even Marxist in orientation, despite the fact that there is a Marxist regime in the capital, Kabul itself. These groups have always vied for power over and control over certain valleys, over certain passes. And what one sees in the resistance groups right now is the traditional pattern of rivalry. For example, some convoys on muleback, on donkeys and camels and things like this, of arms, will be deliberately sabotaged by a resistance group of another group, of another locality. Consequently, they are pinned down, and it's quite simple for the Russians to come along and zap them. Meanwhile, as they get zapped, then the other group can move in and acquire the weapons which were in the convoy itself. So there's a tremendous amount of inter-ethnic rivalry, and you're quite correct in your statement that Afghanistan is made up of many parts and really no whole exists. Although I must say that many of these factions have been brought together in a concerted desire to oust the Russians. But as they have done in the past in their attempts to oust the British had three futile attempts, 1840, 1880, and 1923 to try and establish some force in Afghanistan, and they just gave up and went home. But their mode of opposition is a very traditional one. It hasn't really differed that much from their opposition to the Soviet Union. In fact, I had a colleague who once remarked that the Afghans have never had so much fun since the British were there, in that they do very well what they're doing right now, and that is sniping and raiding, but they simply don't have the leadership, the charismatic leadership, to unite and force the Russians out.
Again, I'm speaking with Professor Nigel Allen, who is a professor of geography from LSU. And you've just been in Afghanistan recently?
No, not in Afghanistan.
I was only in Beijing?
I was in Peshawar, which is the headquarters for the resistance groups. And in Peshawar, Peshawar is up on the northwest frontier province of Pakistan. And in that province, there's approximately 2.5 million Afghan refugees. There's up to about another million in Pakistan in the more southerly province called Balochistan. The estimates on the number of refugees in Iran are highly variable, and it goes somewhere between 500,000 and 1 million. In Peshawar, it's the headquarters of not only the resistance movements, but the worldwide effort, which is a very commendable effort, I must say, at alleviating the plight of the refugees. The entire northwest frontier province is dotted with large refugee camps, and the refugees, I must say, after knowing something about the general welfare of people in Afghanistan, the welfare of these people in the refugee camps is of a fairly high level. They're fed, they're clothed adequately. In many instances, the housing, albeit very rudimentary from our perspective, is sometimes even superior what they had as indentured laborers in some of the larger agricultural estates in Afghanistan itself. So there are many refugee relief groups located in Peshawar. Not only the United Nations, but individual nations have their refugee groups there. And there are hospitals set up by the International Red Cross and by these nations, too.
How long have these camps been in existence?
The major number of refugees came around 1980 and 1981. You remember when the Russians invaded in 1979, there was a considerable movement then. But prior to that, the so-called Saur Revolution took place in 1978, and that's when this one Marxist faction came to power in Kabul. There had been a considerable amount of refugees coming at that time. But even in 1973, when the king was deposed by his cousin, refugees came at that time too. Many of these people were middle-class people, and they came with capital assets such as cars and farm tractors and buses and trucks and things like that. So they brought all movable equipment with them, and they're fairly well set up. Now, the major influx of refugees came around 1980 and 1981, and it's actually still continuing. There's a number given about sometimes 20,000 per month coming to Pakistan at this time, and it really all depends on the impact of the Russian offensives in various parts of the country.
Okay. Excuse me, this may not be a very clever question. How attached are these people to the land that they have left? Are they traditional nomads, or have they given up centuries-old locations?
You have, of course, two basic groups in Afghanistan. You have subsistence agriculturalists who reside in one locality and farm out of that locality and who practice a system of agriculture where they will go up the nearby mountains to the summer pastures with their animals. In addition to that, you have many nomads, and these nomads used to winter in the Indus Plains in Pakistan and then move into the highlands of Afghanistan in the summertime. And when one looks at the statistics on refugees, you must realize that many of these people, hundreds of thousands of them, could also be classified as Pakistan citizens because they wintered in Pakistan and only summered in Afghanistan. But for refugee enumeration purposes, they are counted as refugees because they can no longer continue their annual migration into the pastures in the central interior portion of Afghanistan. So there's essentially two groups there. There's also a number of urban residents, of course. Kabul, when I lived there, was no more than 500,000, and now I hear it's around 2 million. So in addition to migration from Afghanistan to Pakistan, there's a tremendous amount of migration, perhaps equaling that international migration, a tremendous amount of migration from rural to urban in Afghanistan, too, as these people now crowd into the major urban centers, which are fairly well protected by the Soviets and controlled by the Soviets.
I don't think anybody anticipated in 48 when the refugee camps were formed along the Israeli border what a fermenting place for focus and disrest on those whole border disputes in the Middle East those refugee camps would become. Is there any chance that this could in future years be a like situation?
Well, of course, the presence of 3 to 3.5 million Afghan refugees in Pakistan is a tremendous headache for the Pakistan government, because these refugee camps are located along the frontier, and thus far they have not really created a policy to disperse these refugees throughout Pakistan itself. This is a tremendous headache, and it's getting worse and worse, and citizens of Pakistan in some of the more established urban areas, such as Rawalpindi, which is adjacent to Islamabad, the capital, and the great Mughal city of Lahore, as well as Karachi, which is the seaport for Pakistan, they are very upset over the presence of such a large number of people, because already there are signs of unrest in the areas along the frontier. By unrest, I mean this continual sniping and factional fighting which has been carried on in Afghanistan and which has merely been transported over the border itself. When I was in Peshawar, there were bombs going off in hotels, in movie theaters. There were hit squads riding through the bazaar on motorcycles and shooting people of other factions. And I can see these camps being a breeding ground on a scale even grander, if one can use that term, than what when compared to the Gaza Strip itself. And the Pakistanis have to do something quite quickly to either move these people out, whether it'll be moved into Afghanistan, and in which there has to be a settlement, or moved into and dispersed throughout Pakistan. One will have to wait for that decision to be reached.
My impression is that the Pakistani government is using these camps as a kind of bargaining chip for U.S. aid, and especially some military support, which, of course, India is objecting to on some levels. Would you like to comment on that situation?
Yes, that's perfectly true. There has been a military dictatorship in Pakistan until recently. Martial law was lifted when I was there at the very end of the year, 2 days to go, I think, until the end of the year. And civilian rule has been returned. It was a fairly benevolent military dictatorship. There were actually fewer people imprisoned because of their political viewpoints than under the former so-called democratic regime of Prime Minister Bhutto. And it's perfectly true that General Zia, the president of Pakistan, has used the refugees as a bargaining chip to obtain more weapons. I think he is trying to get the Americans to put up something like $6.2 billion in a variety of forms of aid. This is, of course, is a substantial sum, and something has to be done because, as I mentioned, the refugees are a great drain on the Pakistani economy, and also the other major source of foreign exchange for Pakistan, which is remittances from the 2.5 million Pakistanis working in the Persian Gulf. These remittances are declining rapidly because there's far fewer jobs in the Persian Gulf, and many of these Pakistanis are now coming home. So it's in a bind, there's no doubt about that. And that American aid, I think, will certainly continue on the level that it currently exists. And I really can't say how much more is in the pipeline, although various figures are given. The costs of maintaining the refugees are largely borne by foreign relief agencies. However, the social costs, not only the present ones, but the future ones, will be borne by Pakistan, and that's what one should keep in mind at this time.
Do you have any comments on what the Russians are doing in Afghanistan?
The Russians in Afghanistan, their strategy is to maintain basic transportation routes down from Turkmenistan into the city of Herat, which is the city in the extreme northwestern part of Afghanistan, and also on that corridor down to Kandahar, which is a major city in southern Afghanistan. They virtually control the entire north. There's very little resistance activity in the north itself. That's north of the Hindu Kush. And in Kabul, they have a corridor established through the Salang Tunnel down to the city, and the major scene of opposition to the regime is occurring along the border with Pakistan. And it's a very strange situation here because we think of Pakistan as being as having total control over their entire country demarcated by the borders. But this is not really true, for in that area which adjoins the Afghanistan border and the northwest frontier, there is an area called tribal territory. And in tribal territory, tribal law prevails. There are no Pakistani police as such. There are no Pakistani courts. There are tribal courts. There are tribal militia. And the Pakistan government has a person who is still called the political agent to these various sections of tribal territory. And he can be thought of as something like an ambassador to those tribal sections. And this, of course, merely duplicates the system that was put into place by the British very early this century. And it is in this almost no man's land of tribal territory where so much of the mischief occurs here. By mischief, I mean the heroin production. Because the Pakistan government has no right whatsoever to go in there and destroy laboratories which are manufacturing and things like that. That belongs to the tribal authorities. And now if you looked at the television this morning or yesterday, you will see that some correspondents have been permitted to go into Kabul. And what they were taken to see were a number of tribesmen in the Shinwari next to the Khyber Pass. And it's very interesting what's happening here because the Soviets, creating mischief on the frontier, have armed these people, some of whom, a substantial number of whom, come from tribal territory, and they're arming them and training them and then sending them back over into tribal territory in Pakistan, and then they conduct raids out of tribal territory into Pakistan proper. And that's very, very difficult to control, that flow of guns and the movement of these people themselves. Now, in the cities, the Soviets have somewhat duplicated what the British used to do towards the end of the 19th century, and this is divide and conquer. All right, they know that certain ethnic groups had been suppressed by the previous regime. And what they have done is to favor some of those groups. For example, there's a group called Pashai, P, and the language they speak is Pashai. Well, this is a group of mountaineers, we would probably call them hillbillies, they call them Kohistanis over there, who have a language, who are a fairly discreet group in terms of their ethnicity, and yet were suppressed under the former regime in Kabul. And what the Soviets have done is to elevate their language to one of many national languages, and they have radio programs and television programs coming out of Kabul beamed at these people, and they have an institute of Pashai studies and things like this, so that these groups formerly depressed have now enhanced self-identity. And so they've done this with several ethnic groups. Another thing they've done is to cash in on the most deprived segments of society in Afghanistan, and this would mean the women and children. And what they have done here is to establish, certainly in Kabul, establish a large number of schools, of well baby clinics and maternity care and even jobs for women. And by doing that, they are appealing then to a section of society which certainly didn't
Previously disenfranchised.
So these are some of the things they're doing. They're favoring the formerly suppressed groups, and they're also trying to enhance the welfare of other groups outside of the ethnic groups.
I'm afraid we've run out of time. I think you've made an eloquent case for the fact that geography, the complex geography, as it was defined earlier on the program, really has a profound effect on the kinds of policies that the major powers have and the kind of interactions that governments and sort of artificial countries that the big powers may have set up have with each other. I have enjoyed it very much. I have been visiting with Professor Nigel Allen from LSU and Professor Don Lynch, a professor of geography, our only full professor of geography here at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. I hope you'll come back and we'll have more geography discussions. It's something that obviously I think we all need to know a little bit more about. This has been Home Fires Radio Show. I'm your host, Patty Kostelic. Our executive producer has been Carla Tanella. Have a nice weekend.